middle of the week and plenty on the radio from overprotective gull parents and treating the mental health of some of the world's most violent criminals to being diagnosed with autism at the age of 39. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
Joe, every time I go out the back, I'm terrorised.
They dive bomb you.
That's what happened yesterday, and I tell you, I'm in no fit state to run quick.
How can we be sure that this money is going to go safely to where it's meant to go? You know, if you follow us on Twitter, you see the comments from people. I'll never give again. I'll never, I'm going to make sure I never get caught again.
Please don't start, you know, taking out loans to buy NFTs, because this time in a year, you know, they may be worth nothing.
And we'll start here on the live line. Linda called Jo from Artane, where she's been dealing with regular attacks from
seagulls.
Okay, why and where and when?
Well, it's been going on for the past, I'll be as quick as I can, for the past 3 years we've been suffering here along this group of houses. But it's just a continuation. And yesterday when I was out, mm-hmm. I just went out to the shed to put in my injection thing into the shark's bin. And as I was coming out, the seagull came down towards me. I had to kind of back myself back in. So I shouted and my granddaughter came out. Mm-hmm. And then she had to run back in. And then she came out to the shed and then we couldn't get back out because the baby's on the roof and it was walking along. And so they were protected. Joe, every time I go out the back, I'm terrorised.
They dive bomb you.
That's what happened yesterday. And I tell you, I'm in no fit state to run quick.
And are they looking for food, or is it because they've nested on your roof and they have chicks?
Yeah, they've nested along the end house. There's nobody in the end house. And okay. the chicks are moving along. And they're watching. But Joe, it's been terrible. I mean, 3 years, this is the third year. And I can't even walk out the back.
And does it only happen when the chicks are born for the first few months?
Yes.
When the mother is protecting them?
Yes. But also, aside from that, we would always have the pigeons there. Because it's like they're there all the time. Like, it's not like they go away and you come back. They're there. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I just find it too much. I mean, I've nowhere that I can go. Like, I can't go out.
I don't presume you did the job in the house, but for example, who hangs out the washing?
I hang it out when I can get out, or my daughter.
Why? Because...
And that's the way...
You're saying if I walked into your back garden now, a seagull would dive bomb me?
If the chicks... Yeah. Has moved up towards my end.
Okay.
That's in the picture that I sent you this morning. One of them was up just on my roof.
And then Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland talked to Joe about gulls nesting on rooftops.
It's become a more frequent thing in recent years. We are seeing gulls, particularly two species, the herring gull and the lesser black-backed gull, nesting in rooftops, particularly around Dublin.
Okay.
And in many cases, it's what's happened, actually, is that a lot of the places they would have formerly nested, so islands around Dublin Bay, they've become overrun with rats and with mink and with other invasive predators. A lot of human disturbance as well. So these birds are seeking out what to them are islands, so tall buildings, obviously, with roofs that protect them from predators. Yeah, so that's what they're doing. But of course, that sometimes does bring them into conflict with people because they can be very protective of their eggs and chicks.
And is this the time of year for eggs and chicks?
It's exactly. It's the peak time. So it's something we really only see happening in the summer months, yes. So what's happening is now that they would have probably young chicks at this stage, around the time the eggs would be hatching. And so that's when they feel the most vulnerable because the chicks are so small. It lasts for a few weeks, but then it sort of peters out usually into July. And by August, usually the problem has finished at that stage.
But Linda needs to get out to her back garden.
Yeah, I absolutely do sympathise with Linda. It's a big issue for a lot of people. Certainly, the gulls are protected under law. There's nobody, under the Wildlife Act, nobody can harm them or remove them.
Can you not?
No, people would need to contact the National Parks and Wildlife Service.
Can you put nets up or...
Yes. So it is possible to put up deterrents to prevent them from nesting in the first place. And so that is something that people have been doing. One of the issues, of course, is that this bird, of course, is a protected species in Ireland, and rightly so. People think that they've increased in number, and that they're you know, there's so many of them now that come into the cities. In fact, the opposite is the case. It's a species in crisis, and the numbers have plummeted so much. Yeah, so the numbers of the herring gull, which is presumably the species which Linda has been encountering here, they declined by 90% over the course of just 30 years. So the population has really dramatically declined, and it's actually desperation that's bringing them into the cities rather than because they're thriving. We're seeing breakdowns in the marine ecosystem. We're seeing them obviously scavenging from bins and from city streets because it's harder for them to find food elsewhere. And like most animals, and indeed like many humans, they'll take the easy option where it's available. So obviously if they can find a regular source of food, they'll come and feed on that. The nesting on the rooftops is a different issue. So that's when they get aggressive sometimes, because they're defending their eggs, the chicks, but they're very good parents. You know, that their main thing is to make sure that their offspring are okay. But obviously there are some cases as well where they become aggressive to people who have food with them. And so our main thing there is it's important that people don't feed gulls, because it's not good news if they learn to associate humans with food. So that's very important.
Niall Hatch on the Live Line with Joe Duffy. And in the morning, Oliver Callan was talking about this skirmish in the Dáil.
Now, what does the sound of two Cork men roaring over whether one of them made a phone call to the other or not? What does that sound like? It sounds like the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, who's from Turner's Cross, going up the octave at Dibbity Michael Collins, no relation to the big fella. He's from West Cork, so it's City versus Wild West Cork. And by the way, Michael Collins sounds like he's eating the microphone in this clip, which I'm about to play. Virgin Media's Gavin Riley, he said it was an intense moment in the Dáil, the convention centre Dáil, which is still going on. And he singled out this clip about the row, about the phone call. I mean, just listen to how up the octave Micheál Martin goes here.
Deputy Collins didn't ring me. And I think if the situation was that, so he should have rung me, actually. He didn't ring me.
I clarified that, Taoiseach. I rang your office in Dublin. I rang your office in Dublin that morning. And they put me through to the Cork section. And I got no reply since. I left the message. Sorry, but he has to correct the record of the Dáil.
I was not. You know how to ring me. You rang me often enough in previous times.
I never rang you, ever in my life. Because I never got any satisfaction from you.
You did when you were first elected.
You rang me, but I never, looking for a vote. But I knew I wouldn't. I knew you'd turn your back on the people of West Cork. And I wouldn't vote.
You were trying to get
never
a deal
once,
done
never once did I vote.
Trying to get a deal done for yourself. You were
never
talking
once. Never once.
Anyway,
shame on you to lie.
Side.
It's just that we've no idea what the issue is about, but it's kind of vintage Dáil antics. Did you hear the big slang in the match? Yeah, it was great cracker. What were they actually talking about? Did it do anything for anyone? No, it's just that it's the Dáil. That's not the point. It's a bit of banter, like a bit of banter. But it'll never beat the all-time greatest Barney when Michael Healy-Rae exploded. It was up to 7 on the Richter scale.
You should take that back. You're a disgrace.
That's the greatest of all time. It'll never be beaten. You take that back. And he went off. He went off on one big time. Now, what's happening? Bank Holiday is coming up this weekend. And Kate Harrington is tweeting. She's the Labour chair, Galway East and area rep in Tuam. And she says there are two options of the bank holiday. One, hope the entire country gives up drink and adopts a Japanese cultural approach to litter by Friday. Or two, put some bins and portaloos out in the hotspots, collect the bins over the weekend and put some more Gardaí on. So, you know where this is going. And I see the front page of the Examiner, a little story down the end. Cork quays to be fenced off. The Port of Cork plans to fence off sections of its quays ahead of the bank holiday weekend in an effort to prevent large public gatherings. The port company said the move has been taken in the interest of public safety and to accommodate commercial shipping traffic. Oh, they're accommodating commercial shipping traffic, not stopping people congregating and having outdoors. So this is very much the message to young people. You know, we know you've been locked down, but think outdoors, but just not there, not over there. Not Nathan Carter's house, obviously, over there as well, because he's obviously in fierce trouble. You might have heard it says in the papers, the PSNI have issued thousands of pounds in COVID-19 penalties after people attending the party, a party at the home of Nathan Carter. So he's 31, so he threw a big, I don't say a big party, 60 fines anyway, totaling up to £13,000 in his home in County Fermanagh. Now, the interesting thing for me about this story is on the BBC Northern Ireland website, there's a picture of Nathan Carter outside his home and his outdoor garden furniture, right? He's got the armrests are actually wagon wheels. He's 31 years of age. He's got wagon wheel themed garden furniture. I mean, like...
You should take that back! You're a disgrace!
You're a disgrace, Nathan Carter! wagon wheel thing. On the subject of wagon wheels, by the way, this is, you know, just entirely a link to wagon wheels. The company Ferrero from Ferrero Rocher, you're really spoiling us, Mr. Ambassador and so on. They've bought the company Burton's, which makes wagon wheels, and has me salivating at an ungodly hour of the morning about wagon wheels. I just like the little salt. There's a bit of saltiness in there, isn't there? Even though they're shrinking and they're the size of buttons or whatever. They also make Maryland cookies and jammy dodgers, which are no jammy. Would you like a raspberry jammy dodger, Michael?
You should take that back.
Oh, right.
You're a disgrace.
Jeez, sorry. Jeez.
Oliver Callan in the morning. And on Today with Claire Byrne, non-fungible tokens. What are they? Well, take a listen to this.
Ow, Jolly! Ow! Jolly! That really hurt! Jolly bit me.
Well, the Charlie Bit My Finger video has sold for over €600,000. It's the latest in a string of non-fungible tokens that have made significant sums of money at auction. Here to tell us exactly what that means is Ciara O'Brien, business and technology journalist with the Irish Times. Good morning, Ciara.
Good morning.
So this is a new thing that we've been grappling with. What is a non-fungible token?
So basically an NFT is like a digital certificate of ownership. So it's typically done for digital artworks. So there's been a few fairly high profile sales. This would be one of them. It gives you the rights to say, I own this. And you know, it's a bit of a grey area. I mean, even when we were looking into this first, it was all a bit confusing because, you know, you buy the, it's basically having the bragging rights to say you own this, but there are, you know, the artist could then make lots of copies of it and sell those on as well. So for a lot of things, I mean, there's been some fairly high profile sales. Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, sold an autographed version of his first tweet. That, you know, obviously people kind of wonder, why do you want to own these things?
And do you actually own them if the artist can go ahead and make copies?
See, it depends on the actual item. Obviously, things vary. For some people, they will be allowed to make copies and, you know, go on to sell more versions of it. For some, it will just be, you know, they will sell this one item and that's it. Now, like with Charlie Bit My Finger, the whole point of this one was it was supposed to come down off the internet. It was supposed to come down off YouTube when it was bought. So the owner would have the sole rights to this.
I heard
didn't happen.
The parents said, didn't they, that it was time to just get rid of this and they wanted to make some money for their children's education. But that's not what happened.
Well, you see, the person who owned it basically decided not to take it down. It was 3F Music or some person who decided they wanted to own this. They decided to leave it up on YouTube for everybody to enjoy, as is their right. But I suppose there's been so many of these NFT sales. I mean, you saw there was a collage of artwork by an artist called Beeple that sold for, I think it was $69 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been some fairly high profile sales. Grimes sold a collection of digital art. There's one actually that in Ireland where they sold an NFT of a cask of whiskey. Now, that was slightly unusual in that apparently the person who bought the actual digital representation of the cask is going to get the actual cask as well, and it may appreciate in value. So you actually get something concrete alongside your digital artwork. But basically, it's like buying a painting, except you don't actually get the painting. You just have the rights to say you own the painting because the painting is digital.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a bubble to me.
It may well be. Look, the thing is, it's art. To people who are buying NFTs, it's art. And what's art to me may not be art to you.
Yeah.
What's valuable to me, you know, art has value to different people for different reasons, but there seems to be a lot of money in this. And there are dedicated marketplaces to selling these, you know. So if you go to Nifty, a few other places, you can actually buy digital cartoons for, you know, anything from $100 up.
And Claire asked Ciara about ownership of NFTs.
When people buy one of these things, what is stopping other people copying the digital art, or is anything stopping them?
Nothing really. Again, it's like, so say you go to a museum and you see a painting, you know, you might have copies of that painting elsewhere. You could buy a copy of it and hang it on your wall, but you don't own the original. And the value in the NFTs is owning the original, saying I have the ownership of that. I mean, people are, and then they may be able to sell it on, and it depends on how the artist has set it up. The artist may get a cut if something vastly appreciates in value. If you buy something for $1,000 and then, you know, in 10 years time, it's worth $1 million, the artist may get a cut of that. So obviously from an artist's point of view, that's a good thing to do. There is nothing really to stop people from copying it unless you try and erase all copies of it from the internet. But like you've seen before, once something's on the internet, it's very hard to get rid of. Mm-hmm. But it is down to basically, it's kind of like digital bragging rights. You then, I suppose, if you want to sell it on, you have a certificate, and it's kind of certified on the blockchain, so it's practically impossible to fake. It's verified by thousands of computers all over the world that this is yours, and then you can sell it on in the future.
Okay, can you take us through some more examples? Not just the multi-million euro purchase ones, but the ones of lower value.
Well, I suppose the disaster girl meme. Everybody's seen that photograph of a girl smirking and what looks like a house fire. It's actually turned out to be, it was a training exercise for the local fire service, but that sold for 500,000 euro last month. Now, obviously, that's fairly high value. Kinsale Spirits was the company that sold the cask. They raised it for 80,000 euro. I mean, you can go on and you can sell. Like, I could try and sell. I don't think anybody would be interested in my tweets or my buying NFTs of my articles, but you could sell them for, you know, anything from 1,000 euro mm-hmm. upwards if you really want to.
I just wonder, is it a business model? I mean, Kings of Leon are doing it, aren't they?
Yeah, they are using it. I really like this one. They're using NFTs for their new album, and, you know, you'll kind of have golden tickets that will see fans get, say, maybe a front row seat for future tours. Now, obviously, everybody wants to get back to doing stuff like that. So, you know, for things like that, I think that's a great idea. I mean, but look, as I said, when it comes to the digital artwork, you know, it could be a bubble. Mm-hmm. This is the risk you take. It's mm-hmm. like anything, any artwork you invest in, it could appreciate in value. It could go through the floor. You don't really know. And it's the risk that you take when you do get into stuff like this. And again, it's something like, it's like cryptocurrency. A lot of people kind of got involved in that when it started to show, you know, kind of people making serious gains. You know, you don't put money into something that you can't afford to lose. So mm-hmm. please don't start, you know, taking out loans to buy NFTs, because this time in a year, you know, they may be worth nothing.
Kira O'Brien, business and technology journalist with the Irish Times, from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Dear Gay, the thousands of listeners' letters to the Gay Byrne Show and how they helped shape this country. One of Gay's radio producers was John Cadden, and he was talking to Ray about a new TV show based on those letters and working on The Late Late Show.
So where do we start? I suppose with you first. So you started working on The Late Late Show.
Yeah. When you said where do we start, I was going to say it started on The Late Late Show.
There you go. Sorry, I should have pegged the line, John. There you go.
And actually it did, you know. Yeah. And funnily enough, you know, the grandchildren are great with the questions. One of these days I expect one would come up to you and say, "Granddad, do you remember in the olden times, did daddies and mommies actually sleep together?" And I'm a bit reminded of The Late Late Show and the kind of wakening up it gave to people about their personal lives, if you can call it that, you know? Mm. Like, let's face it, before Elon, I won't say there was no sex in Ireland before The Late Late, as some people have said, but there's certainly the public discussion of matters sexual or brackets private was absolutely frowned on and was pretty much taboo for an awful lot of radio and television stations until The Gay Byrne Show or The Late Late Show.
And John, was there a moment that you can remember, a sea change moment?
I think the absolute sea change moment was The Bishop and the Nighty. Ah. And I think that it was a really, really important moment, social moment as well as a broadcasting moment, because the question that Gay was asking was something on the lines of, it was kind of...
We have a recording of it here. Well, I just play it out.
Yeah, because
With sort of 21st century ears, it sounds so innocuous, doesn't it? Well, yes. We play it out and let people decide for themselves. So this was a quiz, and it was sort of a Mr. and Mrs. How well do you know your husband? How well do you know your wife sort of thing on The Late Late Show.
We then asked him, what colour was your honeymoon nightie? Was it A, white, was it B, black, and C, was it some other colour? And for heaven's sake, watch every word you say. What? She didn't wear any.
Completely innocuous. Innocent. She didn't wear any nightie on her honeymoon night.
Yes, you see, it wasn't innocuous, actually, and it wasn't innocent. This was an old trope, you know, that you got in many of these television game shows. And essentially what it was being coy about sex. Mm. right? Wouldn't say it straight out. And what the woman did was she kind of punctured the balloon. She didn't play along with the coyness. She just came out straight and said, I didn't wear anything that night, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I didn't wear a nightie, or whatever the words are. And there was a great laugh and a great cheer from the audience and much concern by the Bishop of Clonfert. And you can imagine in many ways that at that moment, in an awful lot of homes, the parents were saying, well, now, kids, I think it's time for bed, you know, and sending them away. But what she did was she was, you know, pretty much the first so publicly to be so straightforward about her wedding night. And that notion of shame was pushed away. And I thought that was, I always thought that was a really, really, really interesting moment.
And let's listen to the man himself on the death of pregnant teenager Anne Lovett.
You talked about that particular show on Anne Lovett and Granard, and it wasn't all positive. And we've got a little bit from the archives here where Gay addresses somebody who had complained about that particular show.
Okay.
All right, that's the theme music from Brideshead Revisited. About Anne Lovett and Granard, Mary Farrell from County Kilkenny writes to us to say, I wish to protest in the strongest possible way about your reporting of the tragedy of that little girl from Granard. I hadn't realised that you were one of the sensational, insensitive media brigade. Is there no privacy to be allowed to ordinary people anywhere? If it was your daughter, would you like it to be discussed on the radio? Our report of the story in Granard was not callous or insensitive or sensational. You are amongst the few odd people out, Mary Farrell, if that is what you think. So many people have gone to the trouble of getting in touch with us to tell us that it was quite the opposite. And even if they hadn't, I'm telling you that it was not sensational and insensitive. And don't try to tell me otherwise.
The late Gay Byrne. And if you miss it, that TV show featuring the letters to Gay Byrne will be available on the RTE player. It's called Dear Gay. And in the morning, psychiatrist and forensic psychotherapist Dr. Gwen Adshead has spent nearly two decades in Broadmoor, one of Britain's most notorious high-security psychiatric facilities. She was talking to Oliver Callan about the types of patients she's worked with.
Oh, well, they have always committed very serious violent offences. You don't get admitted to a high-security psychiatric hospital anywhere in England and Scotland and Northern Ireland unless you've committed crimes of very serious violence. And the key issue is that it's thought that your mental health problems may have played a part in the violence that you committed. So the people that we look after are people in general who've committed acts like murder, manslaughter, serious violence.
And it's men and women. Women, what do they commit similar crimes to the men?
Well, we don't have any women in Broadmoor Hospital or in any of the high secure hospitals in England and Wales. But when women do commit acts of violence, they commit them far more rarely than men.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the interesting questions that we really don't fully understand, which is why women commit so much less violence than men. But when they do commit acts of violence, they can be quite similar. So women can be convicted of murder and manslaughter in the same way as men can be.
So your job is basically to help, if we can put it that way, sex offenders. You're talking about murderers, people who've committed the unspeakable crimes. What kind of a reaction do you get from people when you tell them what you do for a living?
Well, sometimes people are a bit shocked, and I think sometimes people are a bit offended almost. I think sometimes people think, well, you shouldn't be providing help to people like that. And some people say, well, that's, you know, you're trying to minimize what they've done. And that's really not what we do. What we're really trying to do is provide therapy to disturb people, to improve their mental health, which we also hope will reduce their risk. So this book is really a kind of invitation to come inside and see what happens to people after they've been convicted of terrible violence and to see how we try and help them change their minds for the better and maybe, hopefully, become less risky as a result.
Because you say in the book as well that, you know, you're confronting serial killers often in your line of work, but you describe it, your experience more as sad rather than scary.
I would say so. Yes, that's been my experience, that that, you know, if you're working in a prison or a secure psychiatric hospital, we take lots of steps to keep ourselves safe, and we know where the danger is. So actually, I very rarely felt frightened in my work, but often I feel sad because of the terrible things that people have done, but also the terrible things that have happened to them as well. But I also sometimes can feel hopeful and very, sometimes really privileged to work with a team of people to try and help people change for the better.
And Gwen spoke about some of the patient cases that informed the book.
It was very important to me to work with a professional storyteller and dramatist because, of course, from an ethical and legal point of view, I couldn't actually use people's actual stories in a book. That would be wrong on many levels. So what I needed to do was take tiny fragments of people's stories that were completely unidentifiable and, with Eileen's help, weave them into a narrative. So all the details are clinically real. The things that I've described there have all happened. I actually have heard about them or read about them. Dealt with them myself personally,
yeah.
but every person is a composite of people like that I've seen. So, for example, the very first case is a story of someone who would be labelled as a serial killer because he's killed at least three people, and I've seen several men like that, but I've weaved them into a kind of composite. So to try and get the flavour across of the kind of person that and the kind of story that I've been listening to any time these last 30 years.
It was actually interesting you mentioned the first one because one of the things you say in the introduction is that you won't find these on a Google search result, but that somehow didn't stop me trying to Google the story because you have, as you say, there were at least three killings and one of them was pretty gruesome. It involved a decapitation. Yes. I mean, how many cases are kind of weaved into any particular chapter?
Oh, it can be anything from sort of, the smallest number I think would probably be about five. But the biggest ones might be as many as 200.
There are times where I almost felt guilty for being slightly entertained by what I knew were real and very serious cases that had led to terrible consequences for victims and their families. And you've pretty certain stuff to say about true crime and its industry, the entertainment industry around it.
Well, I understand. Again, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it must be linked up perhaps with our interest in crime and justice. I mean, one of the things that made me want to write this book is is that I know how many people are interested in this kind of world.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone I know has a view about goodness and badness and what should happen to people who've done terrible things. So that's part of the reason that I wanted to write this book. But I was also very clear that I didn't want to write something that was going to be exploitative or salacious in some way. I knew that the material would have to be disturbing because the material is disturbing. But I really didn't want it to be the kind of book that sort of dwelt on the victim's suffering. What I wanted to try and convey is the work and effort and that goes into trying to change somebody's mind for the better. And how important that work is.
And Oliver asked Gwen how she can listen to some of the things violent criminals have done.
Well, I guess, in a way, what I'm doing then is exactly what all, I hope, you know, good doctors do, which is to try and stay focused on the patient and their experience and try and put my own feelings on hold while I listen to what they have to say, because I'm there to try and support them and the work I'm doing with them. So I'm obviously listening very carefully to what they're saying, but there's a part of me, like any good doctor, that tries to stay a little detached, to try and keep my mind and ears and eyes open to what's going on for this person.
Because the odd time you've come across a patient who you initially started thinking about in a negative way.
Occasionally, very much so. I mean, I've had experiences when I came in and I know that I was put off by the patients. The patient might have presented in a sort of angry or standoffish way. There's one man that we describe in the book who started off in presenting in a very arrogant kind of way. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for me to understand that underneath the arrogance was somebody who felt very vulnerable and frightened. and that actually by making it possible, by staying with him, despite feeling annoyed by him at times, by staying with the work, we could help him get to the vulnerability underneath and express sorrow and remorse for what he'd done. And then he was able to go back to prison and work on his offence.
Now, we know lots of people suffer severe mental health problems and they never commit a crime, most of them, in fact. So what causes the people you've treated to become violent and to overstep that mark?
That's a really, really good and interesting question. And in the book, what Eileen and I set out is a kind of theory about that called the sort of bicycle lock theory, which is that in order for an act of violence to take place, you probably need a lot of risk factors in place all at the same time. And things like substance misuse is one thing. Having previously committed violence is another risk factor. And occasionally, paranoid states of mind can be a risk factor. So while it's absolutely the case that very few people with mental health problems will ever be violent, if they do get into paranoid mental states and they do misuse alcohol or illicit drugs, and then if some kind of traumatic event happens to them, often kinds of extensive childhood trauma, that can sometimes increase people's risk of acting violently.
So overall, and it feels like a big ask given some of the crimes that they may have committed, are you hoping to influence people to think more sympathetically to those who end up in places like Broadmoor?
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. I think, you know, when I started, I had the same, you know, fear and anxieties and was perhaps wondering a little bit about whether this was good work to do. But as I've gone on in my work, I've realized that it's possible to have a kind of radical empathy for people, to feel a kind of compassion for people who've done terrible things while also maintaining a little distance. But I really passionately believe that actually, if we invest in helping these people, it's in all our interests that we do that. And we can all benefit from making sure that people who've done horrible things get the support and therapy they need.
And that's kind of important in the context of you talking about the size and the growth of prison populations and the correlation between mental health budgets going down. But the prison populations are increasing despite crime falling. Can you explain a little bit about that to us?
Well, it's difficult, I think. I think that one reason is that for reasons that we don't fully understand, both here and in the States, in the last 30 years, there seems to have been more of a public appetite for revenge. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels like people want longer and longer sentences, and politicians respond to that feeling. And the difficulty about that is that it's actually quite expensive to keep people in prisons for very long periods. It costs quite a lot of money. It can cost anywhere between £20,000 and £40,000 a year to keep someone in prison. So if you're spending that amount of money, I think we have to ask ourselves whether that money might not be better spent on violence prevention, but also perhaps looking at different ways of constricting people's liberty or condemning them, if that's what we want to do. I wonder if really incarcerating people long term is a bit too expensive for us all. We probably need to do better than that. I think, again, it's probably in all our interest to think in a bit of a broader way about how we want to show our disapproval of people who've broken the criminal law.
Well, the disapproval is the thing. It's almost hard to get around, though, isn't it? You know, when a really terrible crime has been committed, and sometimes the emotion goes right across a nation, a society, a population, and we do have that thirst for revenge. What does it say about us? We kind of would say, we don't care how much it costs, lock that person up for as long as we possibly can.
And I understand. I think any of us who work in prisons and the criminal justice system, we understand that revenge is a very powerful kind of emotion. There was a writer called Francis Bacon who called revenge a kind of wild justice. And I think that there's something here about understanding people's passion for justice, but also trying to help people to manage their distress when something terrible has happened, in a slightly different way, while respecting justice without it going wild and getting a bit out of control. But I think we do have to pay tremendous respect to the victims of violence, And in the book, I say how very important it is when I'm working with people who committed acts of violence to remember the people that they hurt and the families of those they hurt. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important part of the work that I do.
The name of the book is The Devil You Know, Stories of Human Cruelty and Compassion. Gwen Adshead was talking to Oliver Callan in the morning. And in the morning, with the handling of finances at the charity Boher in the spotlight, reporter Brian O'Connell was talking to some of the people who raised funds for the charity from Today with Claire Byrne.
In recent weeks, details have been heard in the High Court about alleged financial irregularities at the Irish charity Boher, which have thrown huge question marks over the charity's future. When Brian O'Connell has been looking at this for us, what do we know, Brian?
Well, the High Court has heard that former Boher Chief Executive David Maloney has admitted very significant wrongdoing in relation to the misappropriation of money from the International Aid Charity. Reference was also heard in court to suitcases of cash. As reported by Shane Phelan in the Irish Independent, Mr Justice Sinan Allen said money had been taken in regular small suitcases over the years. So it's not surprising, he said, Mr Maloney was not able to account in detail for this dispersal. The court also heard Mr Maloney has admitted these actions took place over a 20-year period and continued until he was suspended amid investigations into his conduct. But he denies he's liable for the full alleged amount of misappropriated funds, some €1.1 million. There remains clear dispute about how various amounts of money were spent. And also, the founder and former chief of the charity, Peter Ireton, was found dead at his home in Castletroy in Limerick in April in what was described as a personal tragedy. It had been heard in court that Boher was also investigating Mr. Ireton in relation to the allegedly misappropriated money. I suppose Boher has been on the go for 30 years. It began in 1991. It sent its first airlift of 20 in-calf heifers from Shannon to Uganda. And the idea behind Boher was to help families by giving them livestock, especially Irish dairy cows, who are able to produce more milk than local cows. This would enable families to use some of the milk for themselves and then sell on the rest. So very much clear the philosophy behind Boher was a hand up and not a hand out. And it really struck a chord here, particularly in rural Ireland and within the farming community, many of whom dug deep and supported the charity over those years, but also in schools as well. It had a very effective outreach and fundraising programme in Irish schools, and it benefited from thousands of fundraising activities over those years.
And in terms of the people who supported Boher down through the years, you've been speaking, Brian, to some of them.
I have, and this whole scandal has really sent shockwaves through the charitable sector. We've obviously been here before, unfortunately, with cases in the past, and I suppose there was a feeling with a regulator in place now and rules around governance have really tightened up in recent years that the potential for things like this to happen had been minimised and donors could have a large degree of trust. Indeed, if you go on the Boher webpage, there are several sections where the charity outlines how you can be sure your money is going to where it should be. But let me bring you, Claire, some of the people who in different ways supported Boher down through the years, and they feel appalled now by some of the details that have emerged. The organisation, as I said, had a very successful schools programme. It really was a perfect fit in trying to tell that story of agriculture, of development in Africa, and how fundraising can make a difference. So many schools participated in programmes and events. One of them I spoke to was Angela Power. She's principal of St Oliver Plunkett National School in Dublin. It's a special school for children with dyslexia, and I spoke to Angela about their past support for Boher, and she was particularly hurt when it was revealed by what the court heard of former CEO David Maloney taking suitcases of money out of the charity.
Our relationship with Boher started actually about 20 years ago. A teacher in school started to fundraise, and it turned into what we call a Boher Day, which was an entire day devoted to fundraising. But for the first 10 years, that money was exclusively for Boher. And I worked out that we've given Boher about 25,000 over the years, Brian. It's an extraordinary amount of money. But as you know, children have a natural empathy and a natural kindness, and they want to give. So these children would have had little ideas like setting up a nail bar. Now, it's a very small school, Brian. There's only 63 children and 15 staff, but everybody put their heart and soul into this. When you talk about suitcases of money, I can see that money. You know, I can see the staff sitting down and the school secretary bagging coins, 5-cent coins, 2-cent coins when we had them. I can see that physical money. I can see the suitcases of money that were taken because I can see it going directly from a small child who was setting up a nail bar, going into a bag and going into a suitcase and somebody walking out the door with it. So it's very real to me.
Did you ever at any stage over those 20 years have any concerns or suspicions or worries as to where the money was going?
No. Sure, it was lovely, Brian, because it kind of tapped into the animal thing as well. And again, you know, children have an absolute empathy and warmth towards animals. So it ticked so many boxes. And I feel, I can't even go there too much in my own head because I feel a sense of guilt now that we and the teachers in school stood in front of these children and built up Charity Day. And made it such a big deal that here we were, and we were great people, and we were going to help these people.
You must be utterly shocked reading the court reports.
Shocked, heartbroken, concerned about how we approach this in the future. I'm just hoping that none of the children ever ask me, Miss, is our money in one of those suitcases? Like I said to you, we haven't had our charity day for 2 years, but we will have one hopefully next year. We will be sitting there as a staff saying, well, you know, how can we be sure that this money is going to go safely to where it's meant to go? You know, if you follow it, and I know you have on Twitter, you see the comments from people, I'll never give again. I'll never, I'm going to make sure I never get caught again.
Angela Power from Brian O'Connell's report on Today with Claire Byrne. And on the live line, a bit of detective work by Catherine about the online retailer beautyshop.ie.
The product that you bought from online from a group called beautyshop.ie, you have a registered address, we're told, in Fitzwilliam Square in Dublin, not to be confused with any other company or shop by the name with the word beauty and shop in it. Beautyshop.ie, and also they go under Beauty Ireland. Tell us the story. What happened, Catherine?
Okay, so in October of last year, Joe, I had some pigmentation on my face. I'd come out of cancer treatment. I had joined chemo and radiation a few months beforehand.
Okay.
And I had some noticeable discoloration on my skin. Like, you're more sensitive to sun, so I had my freckles were bigger. My freckles were starting to join together into kind of brown spots, and I wasn't liking it at all. So I had previously used an amazing, amazing product called CE Ferulic from a company called SkinCeuticals.
Okay.
It's really expensive, but it zaps discoloration and can really help with collagen production.
It's called CE Ferulic,
yeah,
and the company you normally get it from are SkinCeuticals, and as in cuticles, as in your fingernails. And how much does this normally cost, which you say is very effective? This serum,
it's brilliant. It normally retails for around €150.
Okay.
It's worth every penny of that.
Okay.
But I wanted to kind of buy Irish. Now, you can buy it Irish, but at the time, you know, COVID-19 was going on and I had to protect myself, you know, because I had been out of cancer treatment and all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to buy online, but I wanted to buy from an Irish company.
Okay.
So I saw that an Irish company called beautyshop.ie was selling the SkinCeuticals CE Ferulic serum at a great deal.
And that was the name on the beautyshop Ireland and beautyshop.ie. That was the name used on their website, CE Ferulic by SkinCeuticals.
A picture of the bottle that I use all the time and all that kind of stuff.
And it matched what you...
It matched perfectly, they were selling it for €117 instead of the normal €150.
Okay, a massive 50%, one third off, which is big. So,
so I was like, yes, that's a fantastic deal. So I got on and I ordered straight away. I was delighted with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of weeks, there was no sign of the product. So I sent beautyshop.ie an email and they responded to me and they were apologising for the delay and they were blaming COVID, which is all perfectly understandable at the time. And they sent me a tracking status, but the tracking status just linked me back to my original confirmation email.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't actually, you know, a proper tracking link at all. But look, I thought nothing more of it. Then after a couple more emails to beautyshop.ie, I eventually received my product 32 days after making the order, which is, you know, a long time to be waiting, really. But I was really cross because when the product arrived, it arrived with a British postmark on it. So it had been shipped from England after all the efforts that I'd gone to buy Irish. But look, I was delighted. I was delighted to receive it. You know, we all love getting stuff in the post. So any anger about the delay soon kind of went away. I had a little peek into the bright pink padded envelope that it arrived in, and I did notice that there was no documentation with it. You know, normally you'd get an invoice or something like that. So, you know, that kind of had me kind of going, oh, I wonder where my invoice is. But I didn't think any more of it. So with SkinCeuticals CE Ferulic, it's a product that you put on in the morning. It's a vitamin C. So I was really excited to open up the product the following morning to use it. I did notice as I was taking the plastic off the packaging that it did not have the usual SkinCeuticals seal that's on the packaging. It's kind of a kind of a silvery hologrammy kind of a seal. It's lovely. And I also noticed that some of the font on the box looked a bit different to the previous CE Ferulic that I bought, but I plugged on regardless anyway. When I took the bottle out of the packaging, the wording on the bottle was completely different to the wording on the box. And I'd never seen that before, you know, with my previous purchases. So again, I was kind of like, oh, jeepers. So okay. But I didn't think any further.
And when you say when you say the wording was completely different.
Yeah. So the wording on the the wording on the bottle was completely different to the wording on the box. When I say that was like, I've sent on photos there to you. I can't exactly remember the wording now, but they were completely different anyway. And the font was also a little bit different. I opened up the bottle anyway. So it was then that I really noticed that something was not quite right, because the colour and the consistency of the product were totally different.
And we're talking about a liquid or a cream or...
It's a liquid. It's a 30ml bottle with a dropper.
A dropper, like an eyedropper.
Yeah, it's brown. A bottle. The brown bottle is supposed to stop the product from oxidising.
Yeah, of course.
And then when you open this product, you have literally 2 months to use it within before it kind of oxidizes.
So how was the product?
Well, when I opened the bottle, it was a different color, different consistency. Normally, it's a pale, kind of a clearish color. And this was browny, like real dark brown. And CE Ferulic doesn't smell great at the best of times, to tell you the truth, Joe. But the product that I got from beautyshop.ie smelt a bit bleachy or washing up liquidy, and there was bubbles in it.
Did you ever, in your previous administration of CE Ferulic, ever taste it, Catherine? Yeah, accidentally, no,
taste it? No. Yeah. No, never. Okay. It does smell a bit like kind of hot dog water. I've tried it before, it doesn't smell great, but it does not smell like cleaning fluid or something like that. And there's never bubbles in it. Never bubbles in it. And there was bubbles in this.
So Catherine contacted beautyshop.ie about the product.
So I contacted beautyshop.ie straight away.
What was your worry?
My worry was that the product maybe had oxidized or something like that, or, you know, that there was some fault with the product. Skin was already sensitive after the chemo, so I wasn't going to do anything.
And you're talking about administering something to your face. In a very, as you say, very, not just a sensitive area, but a sensitive situation because you've just gone through cancer treatment. Okay, so you emailed them.
I did. I contacted beautyshop.ie straight away and they told me to send them photos, which I did. I sent them photos from all angles They emailed me back then saying that something like personal grooming products cannot be returned once the packaging has been opened. But they did say send it on to us and we'll investigate. And if we find that there is anything wrong with it, we'll give you a refund.
So you asked for a refund because it didn't smell or look or feel like the same product that you bought from the manufacturer previously. You're now buying from a third party. But they said, because you opened the bottle and discovered that it smelled differently, we can't give you a refund. How else would you have discovered that it was different?
Yeah, I know. And now I can't remember if I actually asked them for a refund. I sent them the email telling them that there was something wrong with the product. Okay. Yeah, and they said to me, they said all that, like, if you've opened it, or they said if the security seal has not been tampered with, then, you know, or if the security seal has been tampered with, then, we may not be able to do anything for you. But the returns address they asked me to return it to Joe for an Irish company was number 30, third floor, the Circus Bath, Somerset. And the Circus in Bath is beautiful. It's one of the places I've always wanted to visit. So I was like trying to figure out, my God, where would they keep their, production centre there?
Now, did you get the name? You then posted a negative comment online.
I did. Can I bring back to SkinCeuticals there, actually? Because I contacted SkinCeuticals directly myself and they also told me that they weren't authorised sellers.
Oh, very good, yeah.
That's Catherine on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Jodie O'Neill told Ray about being diagnosed with autism at the age of 39.
So I suppose even before our son would have been diagnosed, I would have felt that he was very much like me. And so we kind of delayed even getting a diagnosis because I was like, well, sure, he's exactly like me. He reacts to the world in the same way I do. And when he got his diagnosis, I began to read life accounts by autistic people, to watch videos online by autistic people. And it resonated with me so strongly in relation to my own childhood and my adulthood and my own experiences. So I kind of started to very slowly identify as autistic myself. And then I pursued a formal diagnosis in 2019. Right. So,
but that's fascinating, isn't it? Because I can see those conversations you have with yourself about Tom. Sure, he's normal. He's like me.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
I don't have autism, so he doesn't have autism.
Yeah, and I suppose you have a very superficial idea of what autism is if you haven't kind of experienced it and if you haven't, gone down the research route like I have now. You might have a very superficial idea. You might have, Rain Man in your head as a picture of that's autism without knowing that autism is myriad things and myriad experiences and ways of experiencing and interacting with the world.
I know we're talking about your story, but what age was Tom when he was diagnosed?
Four.
Four, okay, right. And would that be late or would that be around the age?
I think for boys it's in or around, it depends really on whether you can kind of go down the private route or the public route, because public route you're going to be waiting a bit longer.
Okay.
Generally, but I think it's, it's normally at that age of kind of starting to interface with the education system and, being out of the home a little bit more and out of your comfort zone, that these kind of differences might start to show a bit.
So what specific aspects of your behaviour were the red flags?
That's interesting. So my kind of social anxieties and awkwardness and my
What did you put them down to? Because you didn't have an explanation for them before you got your diagnosis.
Yeah, shyness, I suppose. I would have put it down to shyness, to awkwardness, to incompetence. I would have always known that I was good in a kind of a one-on-one setting, but might struggle more in a larger group setting. And I think what happens when you become a parent is that a lot of the experiences as a parent reflect experiences as a child. So that school gate interaction with all the other parents, I was suddenly like right back in the corridors of secondary school going, oh, I don't belong here. I don't know what to do. And so it makes you examine, I think, your life from a different perspective when you become a parent, because you're experiencing it alongside your child, but also you're in a new kind of realm in your own life. So I think a lot of the scaffolds that I had built for myself in terms of how I navigated the world kind of came crashing down over the space of a few years of realizing that I had to kind of go into settings where I was deeply out of my comfort zone.
And I've spoken to Temple Grandin before, amazing woman. And I've watched a documentary on her, and she is autistic, and she learnt what she should do in social occasions. So she learned how to behave. It didn't come naturally to her.
Yeah.
I found that very interesting.
Yeah.
So was that your situation as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would find somebody who was very at ease with their environment. So in school, in primary school, secondary school, college, right the way through, I'd identify, okay, that person is at home. That person does the right stuff. I'll just do what they do.
Right.
And I'll see how I get on. And that works to an extent. But yes. Then, you know, when things don't go the way that you predict or they don't go the way you expect, or say I would have been very good, you know, I've done a lot of theatre work and I would have been good on the first day of rehearsals because I would know that's all new and it's all new to all of us. But the second day, where all the relationships have kind of invisibly started to form and I don't know how to find my way into that, I would struggle more.
Okay.
So, and I'd be good, you know, for as long as we're rehearsing, there's a script, there's a director, somebody is telling you what to do and how to behave. But then the kind of outside the social element is much more challenging.
And what did the diagnosis mean to Jody?
Yeah, I think it changes everything, really, because you navigate the world with a different knowledge. So you can kind of, I suppose I articulated as stop being a failed neurotypical person and stop trying to be this idea of what people or what you perceive people expect you to be. And you can start focusing on, OK, well, what are the things that I would actually like to be? What's the stuff I would like to do? And how can I make that achievable for myself? What accommodations do I need to put in place? So, for example, this year I've done a huge amount of public speaking, which is not something I would ever have done before. But what I realized was that, OK, yes, I do want to talk about it because, you know, every so often when you speak about this, a little, you know, light bulb goes on in somebody else's head and they go, ah, that's me.
Right.
And so because I did want to keep doing it. But in order to do it, I have to have a script in front of me.
Right.
And I have to read from the script. And that's just how
that's
it
fine.
Works.
Sure, most people do that.
Yeah. But you think that they don't. You think people have this innate knowledge of the world that you don't have.
Because you mentioned earlier on that there's no cure for it. So there's no treatment as such. So with your diagnosis didn't come a prescription that you went down to the pharmacy with, did it?
Yeah, no, there are all kinds of therapies that you know you can look into. It's not something, because I think I was in the midst of the production of What I Don't Know About Autism when I found out about my own diagnosis. So my kind of learning curve has been very self-led. I do know people who would access occupational therapy or speech and language therapy at a later age. And interestingly, I did go through speech and language therapy in college.
And the occupational therapy, is that because your spatial awareness is different than a neurotypical person?
So it's autism would commonly impact people's gross and fine motor skills.
Right.
But also your proprioceptive awareness.
Go on, explain that to me.
So your sense of where you are in relation to the world. So like I studied ballet for 18 years, so I would think that I have a reasonable level of coordination, but sometimes I just don't know where I am. So I can remember I used to do a lot of waitressing. I can remember being in a restaurant, bringing a glass of water to a customer and just not making the connection between I need to put my hand down on the table.
Okay.
So just dropping the glass of water, or, you know, walking into table 11, maybe 40 times in a week. And that's impacted by tiredness and stuff. But, you know, so occupational therapy would help with all that, but also would help with executive functioning, which can be a little bit impaired sometimes or different in autistic people.
Right.
Is that your, that kind of organizational level and your
that's
sense
impaired.
Of yourself
in
the world.
Yeah. So you have to work on that.
Yeah.
That's Jody O'Neill on The Ray Darcy Show. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.